Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, October 4th, 2018. A South Sudanese official levels false accusation against the U.S. government.
The very U.S. Congress, which is toured with the SPLM-SPLA, has classified the members of SPLM-SPLA as belonging to a terrorist or undesirable organization whose members are eligible for entry to the United States.
And the director of a South Sudanese think tank says the outgoing head of JMAC has left no legacy.
Mohai increasingly became the guest of the government of South Sudan and not of the African Union and IGAD that had put him in that place. So as a guest of the government, he was always only giving a slap on the wrist, even when the government side had been the biggest perpetrator.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Officials with the South Sudan ruling SPLM party are falsely accusing the U.S. government of categorizing the SPLM and the SPLA as foreign terrorist organizations. Party officials held a press conference today in Juba to protest against what they call the maiming of the SPLM. Gwen Uten has this report for VOA from Washington.
Cole Atem, the SPLM Secretary for Political Affairs, made the false accusation today in Juba.
There is no reason, any reason or from any country that is aware of the international, regional, and national legal instrument regarding political parties and armies of a sovereign state to label SPLM and SPLA as a terrorist organization. This is a great vilification and maiming of the sovereignty of the Republic of South Sudan, since SPLM is the ruling party and SPLA is the national army.
The U.S. government follows legal criteria for designating entities as terrorist organizations. It must be a foreign organization and it must engage in terrorist activity as defined by the Foreign Relations Authorization Act. The organization's terrorist activity must also threaten the security of U.S. nationals, national security, or the economic interest of the U.S. Atem says the South Sudan government is disappointed with how U.S. officials are handling South Sudanese who wish to travel to the United States.
It's astonishing to have learned that the very U.S. Congress, which is toured with the SPLM-SPLA since liberation struggle, has classified the members of SPLM-SPLA as belonging to a terrorist or undesirable organization whose members are eligible for entry to the United States and be given waiver visas after mind-blocking delay. This is unacceptable, and SPLM leadership protests that in the strongest term possible.
Atem warns that classifying the SPLM and SPLA as terrorist organizations, which the U.S. has not done, may affect South Sudan's relationship with the U.S.
SPLM demands that the government of the United States should withdraw immediately such classification and ensure that its members are not undermined as such, for it may affect bilateral relations between South Sudan and United States of America.
The U.S. Embassy in Juba has declined to comment on South Sudan's false accusation. Last week, Valentino Bach, the undersecretary of South Sudan's Foreign Affairs Ministry, said he handed U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Thomas Hushek a letter of protest against what he calls a U.S. congressional decision to blackmail some South Sudanese government institutions as terrorist organizations and for delaying or denying them visas visas to the United States. Several South Sudanese officials complained they were not provided visas to attend the UN General Assembly that was held last week in New York. But the U.S. State Department released a statement saying several visas were issued to South Sudanese officials that allowed them to attend the event. For VOA News, I'm Gwen Uten in Washington.
The German ambassador to South Sudan says his government is ready to support any efforts that can bring about lasting peace in South Sudan. But Jan-Henrik Van Thiel says Germany also wants to see an end to killings, rape and other abuses in the country. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at an event marking the Day of German Unity celebrated every October 3rd to commemorate the anniversary of German reunification in 1990, Ambassador Van Thiel said Germany welcomes the signing of the revitalized peace agreement but urged South Sudan's political leaders to move the peace process forward.
Germany is in support of comprehensive and lasting peace in South Sudan, and we are supporting all avenues, be it the African Union, be it the HRIF, be it the national dialogue, which lead to this end of sustainable and comprehensive peace in South Sudan.
Van Thiel says as the peace deal is implemented, South Sudan's leaders must allow space for all political parties to express themselves freely.
As much as we acknowledge the signature of an agreement, the real thing comes afterwards. The concrete steps to build peace, reconciliation and development are in the country of South Sudan. The people of South Sudan, who in the future are not going to be killed, raped, maimed or looted, the farmers working on their fields without fear of violence, the children going to school and not being recruited in militia, and all the politicians of all parties expressing freely their views without any fear. These are some of the many, many points which real peace in this country means.
The German government has set aside $160 million to support development activities and provide humanitarian assistance to more than 500,000 South Sudanese most affected by the conflict, especially in parts of Greater Bahr el-Ghazal and Equatorial regions. Van Thiel says in order to do that, attacks on aid workers and humanitarians must stop.
In these regions, we address the plight of malnourished children and women, and at the same time, we assist farmers to increase their output through the provision of seeds, tools, training on sustainable agricultural production methods. We could also visit the 260,000 South Sudanese in Yei, Torit, Yambio, and Juba.
Van Thiel says aid workers provide access to clean drinking water and better sanitation, as well as assisting former child soldiers who have been demobilized. The German ambassador says Berlin will continue to improve its bilateral relations with Juba, but also continue to express its opinion on issues of interest to both Germany and South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio. In Juba.
Still on matters to do with peace in South Sudan, earlier this week, the former president of Botswana, Festus Mogae, told South Sudanese leaders to implement the revitalized peace deal signed on September 12th. But the director and co-founder of the Juba-based SAD Institute, Jock Madu Jock, says Mogae did not do a very good job as the head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, also known as JMAC.
Well, initially, the coming of JMAC under President Mogae raised the hopes of the people of South Sudan on two accounts. One is that President Mogae, having been a president of Botswana and a winner of the prize for good leadership, gave people of South Sudan a sense that maybe he can use the skills that he used to run his country so well to steer the peace process. So that was one of the reasons why people were so jubilant about his appointment to lead the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission.
What is the problem with Mogae? I mean, I've been hearing a lot of complaints from South Sudanese that he did not do the job according to their expectations. What is your take on this?
The main expectation that people had put on him and on JMAC as a whole was that it would be even-handed in demanding some action from all the parties that had signed ARCIS, and that the demands would be to the parties to stick to the spirit and the letter of the agreement. Now, when it came to doing this, many people on the government side were bent against JMAC whenever JMAC criticized them for not doing their part. So increasingly, the people of South Sudan began to feel like JMAC was simply put there to whitewash the intransigence of the government of South Sudan and to keep the other parties on fire for not doing their part, while allowing the government, especially those who are represented on the commission, who had regular meetings together in JMAC, letting them off the hook.
My understanding of the role of JMAC, and specifically President Festus Mohae, is as a referee. You know, take an example of a soccer match. The referee is to warn the players and punish the players and, you know, moderate the match. What was your reading about some of the ways that Mohae was really moderating the issues to do with peace in South Sudan?
Well, Mohae increasingly became the guests of the government of South Sudan and not of the African Union and IGAD that had put him in that place. So as a guest of the government, he was always only giving a slap on the wrist, even when the government side had been the biggest perpetrator of the violations that led to the weakening of the peace agreement. This point came to a head after July 2016, when there was that fight in J1, clearly it became that the agreement had failed because the parties that had signed had changed positions. Riek Machar left, Thabang Dengai took over, but no accountability for the actions that followed. People of South Sudan, especially those parties in South Sudan that were victims of the intransigence of the government of South Sudan.
And Mohae said he's not willing to serve as the chairman of JMAC. He said his time is up and he wants to give the seat to someone else. Whoever is going to be replacing Mohae, what should this person do to make sure that the parties to this conflict adhere to the commitments they have made in the agreement?
Anybody who has to take over this job will have to, first of all, speak very clearly to say, what exactly do they expect him or her to do? If the expectation is that the new revitalized JMAC, so to speak, would have to be a real monitor and reporting to parties that are willing to act if the peace agreement is not being implemented, then the grantors have to act. If the process is just going to continue to be what it has been, which is that violations happen, and then you give them a moral equivalency instead of assigning blame, then really I would never take that kind of job, which then ends up being a failure, and then the failure is pinned on that individual or on that entity.
That's Jokmadu Jok, director and co-founder of the SAD Institute. He was speaking with me from New York this past hour. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the ICRC tries to convince armed groups and their leaders to stop violence against civilians. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you believe Africa can do without aid from Western powers? Why or why not?
Yes, we have so many things. We are blessed as Africans. We have fertile soil. Without even applying like manure or something of that kind, you can still plant. We have so many things that can earn us living without getting aid from the Western countries.
Africa with no aid from US, I think it's a big no. We are not yet there.
Africa has everything it needs. We have a population. We also have resources. What we need is actually leadership and a change of the value system.
Africa can do it. Africa is capable of doing that, that aid. One country, Libya, if Libya was able to do it without the Western aid, we are all able to do it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The International Committee of the Red Cross is working to influence the values of armed groups and encourage combatants and their leaders to stem violence against civilians. The ICRC is training relief workers in South Sudan to dialogue with local leaders and appeal to traditional customs that may mitigate violence and protect women and children in conflict. William Eagle reports for VOA from Washington.
A study by the ICRC looks at ways that humanitarian organizations can curb violence and encourage cooperation among a range of armed groups, from centralized state militaries and ideologically driven groups to those with fragmented leadership influenced by local values. The more centralized groups tend to be well-trained and disciplined, with rules and values established in doctrine and enforced by top commanders. These include national militaries and ideologically disciplined groups that are not supported by government resources and infrastructure. Among them are the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq and past African liberation movements. The study found that military in some countries were more likely to be influenced by instructors with combat experience as well as knowledge of international humanitarian law, or IHL. It also found that group values, such as warriors' honor, tend to discourage soldiers from acts of violence against civilians, including rape and other abuses. Dr. Fiona Terry is the head of the ICRC's Center for Operational Research and Experience in Geneva.
The norms of restraint really need to be socialized much more into the military. It's got to go beyond just the socialization in you can't do this, it's against the law. Respect for the law gains a lot more traction if you're able to make it about the identity of the soldier. It's not what I do. I don't do it because it's against the law. I don't do it. I don't violate IHL because it's not who I am.
The ICRC says a different approach is needed for armed groups with loose or fragmented leadership. Many smaller groups have little, if any, formal training in curbing violence and protecting human rights. Some are made up of local fighters who are embedded in the community and are mobilized only temporarily. That is the case in parts of South Sudan, where the ICRC studied cattle herders and pastoralists among the Dinka and Nuer. Humanitarians found that some norms of restraint were transmitted by culture, like cattle camps, where young men learned to raise livestock. Others were influenced by prophets and spirits. Fiona Terry explains.
In the Nuer tribe, there is the sort of the Nuer spirit is the bad blood. And if you commit atrocities, then you are pretty much damned. But you could perhaps in the past have had prophets reinstating the good blood. But it seems that for many of these fighters, it's gone too far almost, and they sort of have abandoned the idea that they are redeemable, and therefore the violence has spiraled.
Terry says it's not clear if this or other customs could be revived in an effort to encourage restraint or if traditions could be used to introduce concepts of international humanitarian law. In one example, an ICRC first aid trainer and local men compared the law of war with rules for traditional wrestling.
Once he'd heard the explanation, would then play a bit dumb and sort of say, well, hang on a sec, I don't really understand. So you like to wrestle, but could you challenge that woman over there to this wrestling match? And of course the guy thinks, oh my God, how stupid, she's far too weak and she would never be a match for me. And what about that child over there? No, the same thing, you know, derisive laughter bursts forth. And then on that basis, being able to open up and to start discussing, well, it's the same thing in warfare. You also, you know, don't challenge people who are not the same capacity of you. They are not worthy to meet you.
The ICRC study provides its project leaders with a simple blueprint to help identify the differences in discipline, leadership, and values between formal armed groups and those with looser or local leadership. It says identifying and negotiating with those who influence combatants can make it easier for humanitarian groups to deliver relief and staunch violence against civilians. Red Cross officials say that idea couldn't be more timely. They say more armed groups have emerged in the last 7 years than in the last 7 decades. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
U.S. First Lady Melania Trump is expected in Kenya on her tour of Africa. Anzette Sewere is a Kenyan development economist and a newspaper columnist. Reporter Ruben Chama asked her how people in Kenya view Mrs. Trump's visit.
Well, I think firstly, it's a sign of goodwill from Trump administration that she's coming and expressing interest in Africa and in Kenya. But of course, the bigger question many Africans will have is, will Trump come? Will he ever come? Is he going to come? So I think it's welcome. So it's just a sign of goodwill.
Why do you think she chose to visit Kenya in particular?
Well, I think Kenya has had very strong relationships with the U.S. for a very long time. I mean, if you look at the key economies on the African continent, if you look at Greater East Africa, Kenya is a key economy. And I think also more broadly speaking, if you look at the importance Kenya plays in the U.S. Efforts on ending terrorism, particularly, you know, issues such as Al-Shabaab. So Kenya has always been important both from an economic point of view, from a military point of view, but also you know, sort of more socially speaking, around the involvement that the U.S. government has, just in the governance conversation the country has.
Do you see any economic or political issues between the two countries?
Well, I mean, I think if there are, Melania won't be in an official position to comment on it. I mean, she can't negotiate on behalf of the U.S. government, obviously. So I really think this is just more about a soft power move. Demonstrating to the Kenyan people that the U.S. is still present and still notices and appreciates the presence of our country. But I don't think anything concrete in terms of economic or political outcomes will come out of this in terms of government-to-government interaction.
And Azenze, Mrs. Trump also launched a campaign, and I think some of our interests include cyberbullying and also drug abuse. How serious are these issues, especially among Kenyan youth?
Well, I think drug abuse is an issue that's growing in concern. I think because of the exposure that particularly the young Kenyans have to international media and the types of drugs that are becoming increasingly available in the country. So I think that's relevant. I think cyberbullying is also important, particularly for young people who are active online. There have been cases where people have been bullied online and sort of the negative fallout from that. I don't think these are necessarily priority issues. I think if you talk to young people, they'd be more concerned about joblessness and idleness and not being able to earn a living after they've gone to school and education. So I think in terms of the priority of things, it may not be up there, but it's definitely stuff that young people grapple with.
And finally, how popular is President Trump in Kenya? Is our visit expected to affect how the president or the U.S. is seen in Kenya?
Well, I don't know what other Kenyans think of Trump, but I think Melania's visit is welcome. I think this government and this administration has always made it clear that they seek to interact with the Trump administration. A few weeks ago, President Kenyatta went to visit Trump in the USA. So I think in terms of economic interactions, there is momentum behind both governments to take the conversation forward. And I think Melania is just another dip in the ocean in terms of fostering relations between the two countries.
That was economist Nzenze Were speaking with our colleague Ruben Chama in Nairobi. Still in East Africa, South Africa has announced that Kiswahili will be introduced as an optional language in schools by 2020. The announcement has been welcomed by many who want to see the language, known in English simply as Swahili, become the first African language spoken across the continent. Tuso Kumalo reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
Jambo, hello, asante sana, thank you. Kiswahili, a language spoken by more than 100 million people across East and Central Africa, will soon be available for study in schools in South Africa. The government's announcement in September to add Swahili as an optional foreign language in 2020 surprised some South Africans. Despite it being the most widely spoken tongue across Africa, South Africa has few Swahili speakers, but the move to add Swahili was broadly welcomed as a first step towards promoting a pan-African language. Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF party leader Julius Malema says, Swahili provides Africa a chance to free itself from colonial shackles.
We must have a language that unites Africans. If Swahili can be developed and it becomes a continental language, and then we do away with speaking to each other in English.
English is unlikely to lose its status as one of the most widely spoken tongues in Africa, where more than 23 countries recognize it as an official language. By comparison, Swahili is an official or national language in only 5 of Africa's 54 countries: the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Uganda. But unlike English, Swahili could provide a more native connection between African people. Isa Kenya is a Kenyan national living in Johannesburg.
It's a Bantu language for Africa, and a Bantu is everywhere. Even in South Africa, Zulus, they speak all the same as the Swahili. And it will be easiest for African people to communicate when the African Union opens the border.
Swahili has for centuries been the language of commerce in East Africa, becoming a second language to tens of millions across trading routes. Sipho Mutema is principal of the Christians Institute of Learning in Johannesburg.
Learning about the depths and the wideness of one's language, it is a way of finding one's identity. I think it will bring togetherness, something that I will call Africanness.
Others argue that on a continent with 1.2 billion people and more than 2,000 languages, Kiswahili has more than a few hurdles to leap before becoming Africa's common language. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Mfalme ya Amani by Solomon Mukubwa.
Kijana sasa ni mzee. Daudi kasema nilikuwa kijana sasa ni mzee. Sijawahi ona mwenye yake ameachwa mimi, wala watoto wake kuomba omba mikate barabarani. Mungu ni mwaminifu kwa ahadi zake wanadamu. Mungu ni mwaminifu kwa ahadi zake si kama wanadamu. Bwana wa amani, ninamuita mfalme wa amani Bwana. Ndio maana mimi ninaimba kwa sababu ya amani yake. Ni uwezo gani unaompinga Yesu? Uwezo gani?
We've been listening to Solomon Mukubwa with the song Mfalme ya Amani, which means in Swahili, King of Peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you making us part of your evening. If you would like to share something with us, you can send us on, you can send it on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at VOA South Sudan. Please join us tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.